Welcome to the Science Witch Podcast, where we explore how science and witchcraft intersect, interact, and affirm one another. I'm your co-host, Ruby.
I'm your co-host, Angel.
And I'm your co-host, Enku, and this is our 64th episode. In this episode, Ruby and Angel talk with Sensei Strange, a stage magician who draws inspiration from his history with the occult and spiritualism.
But before we get to Sensei Strange, we're also excited to introduce James, the newest The newest member of the Science Witch podcast team as a host and editor. James, welcome to the show. Would you like to introduce yourself to our listeners?
Hi, I'm James. I'm a transmasc genderfluid person who uses he and they pronouns. For now, I would call myself a witch poser. I like to adorn myself and my house with the trappings of witchiness and paganism without really actively practicing. I'm still trying to find spirituality in my life. Anyway, I've known Angel for about 10 years, and Angel, Enku, and I play D&D together regularly. So that's how I know y'all.
Yeah, welcome, James. It's great to break you out of the D&D sphere and, get to hang out a little bit more.
Hell yeah.
Ruby is also on our D&D game.
Yeah, I also do play on that, and I was also going to say I do also, consider myself a bit of a baby witch. I am still just kind of learning the ropes, so Jamie, you and I are right along there together.
100%.
So for this episode, what was especially interesting for me was in thinking about the relationship between stage magic and, you know, magic with a capital K. It can be a contentious relationship, and it comes out in strangest stories and perspectives. But for me, I also started thinking about how magic and ritual and a lot of healing practices always have some element of theater to them. Even going to the doctor is theatrical. And the cultivation of wonder and possibility through interaction is an important part of shaping the world, be it a podcast or stage magic or anything else we're doing in the world. So, yeah.
Yeah, particularly what I liked from that interview was we were commiserating a little bit about our respective fields. Of course, this guy's a magician, I'm a musician, so that we're still both in the performing arts. And we were talking about how there's this danger of gatekeeping in our communities and how there's this danger of becoming a cult leader, because when you're in front of a stage, in front of a group of people, that is a very powerful thing. It's very much like holding clay in your hands. Mm-hmm. But we were also talking about how one of our main goals as professional artists is to break down that barrier as much as we possibly can, or at the very least, walk around it, because, seriously, that's how cults start, is with very charismatic individuals who are very good at performance. But I also just... Other than that, I really just loved getting to see his puppets and seeing how some of them worked. It was just an overall fun time to talk with this guy.
And I got to mention one of my favorite authors that has become a regular theme on the podcast, and that, of course, is Robert Anton Wilson, who Sensei Strange also references in this interview. So anytime we talk about the perils and paths of studying the occult, but not wanting to completely go off the deep end into Chapel Perilous, Robert Anton Wilson is always there with his sage wisdom.
If I could just say for a second, yeah. I wish I could have been there for this interview. It was recorded before I kind of joined the team. But he also mentioned that he spent some time in Japan, and I also lived in Japan for a few years. And so it would have been cool to talk with him. But yeah, without further ado, let's get to our interview with Sensei Strange.
Hello, everyone. Thank you again for tuning in to this episode of the Science Witch Podcast. Today, We have a special guest who's going to bridge a topic that I've always, like, I've had a little bit of interest and knowledge of because my spouse does card magic and coin magic. And I met Sensei Strange at an event that you were presenting as you were doing a magic show. So we talked about you coming on the podcast to talk about the intersections of what is stage magic with a K, which is, of course, you know, witchcraft and the occult. So yeah, let's go ahead and start out by having you introduce yourself to our listeners and telling us about your journey in both the stage magic and the occult.
Well, hello, my name is Eric Pearson, but in the world of magic, I'm known as the all-seeing, the all-powerful, the all-knowing, the enigma, the mirage, the spellbinder, and the master of the weirding ways. Sensei Strange, more elegant magic for a more civilized age. So, I'm from Texas. Grew up in the Dallas area. I moved to Japan, moved to England for a while, worked in Belize, eventually landed in Austin, Texas for the last 18 years. And then during the COVID times, decided I wanted to see what trees looked like and not be baked by sun and not have Ted Cruz represent me. So we decided to move up to Oregon and check out what's going on here. So I'll just keep rambling on until anybody stops me. So some of my, I guess, background in it, I was kind of raised in an environment where the otherworldly stuff was somewhat accepted, at least when my dad wasn't around. My great-grandmother was back in the early 1900s, was a spiritualist priest, you know, running seances and talking to ghosts and whatnot. And my grandmother was raised into that too, but she had a heavy Polish Catholic mysticism sort of bend whenever we were around. My mother was definitely into the new age psychic wave of like the, you know, 70s, 80s, and 90s. So, you know, she had the crystals everywhere and always going to psychic conventions. But my father, of course, very much like the Emperor tarot card, was the skeptic scientist, and none of these things would be discussed when he was around. But I suppose my particular journey all started when two things I received when I was 7 years old. This book in the mail, it's called Mysteries of the Unexplained. And it was, no one knows who sent it to me or why, but it's full of, oh, Bigfoot and UFOs and tales of witchcraft and frogs falling from the sky and all these things that suddenly made my world a little bit more entertaining. And that pretty much started the sweet tooth of trying to journey and find everything a little bit strange or unusual or bizarre. And then, of course, when I was a little bit younger, you know, the Star Wars movie came out and Obi-Wan Kenobi by Alec Guinness, the sort of magician, warrior magician sort of archetype was presented to me. And I was just like, yes, that's what I want to be. And that's kind of what I've aspired to for the remainder of my life.
When did you start doing stage magic? How did that come about?
So I started getting into a buddy of mine that I went out to Burning Man with the first time in the late 90s. He showed me a piece of silk and then put it in his hand and it vanished. And I was just like, you know, a state of amazement and wonder happens when you get effectively magic is presented to you. And I was just like, yes, I want to be able to do that to other people. I want to give them the gift of astonishment and wonder. And that was shortly before I was slated to move to Japan on through the JET program, exchange teaching program. I didn't speak any Japanese. And I was like, man, I've got to figure out a way to flirt with girls. Magic was a great way to start. Unfortunately, the Japanese women are too smart to fall for this.
But your American tricks.
But I started getting into the doing some slight tricks at parties. I got really into contact juggling. You know, the David Bowie.
Oh yes, yes, that's so funny. My husband also came into doing coin magic and card magic from contact juggling.
Yeah, so I'd be at parties performing and people were like, yeah, you're the greatest magician I've ever seen. And I'm like, oh, well, I guess I better start learning some more magic then.
Yeah, high expectations.
And then me a video of magic, and how to manipulate balls in a magical way. And it just so happened we came back from Japan to go to Burning Man, and the guy's video that I was just watching, he walked up to me and threw some streamers and walked off, and I was like, You come back here. And so, you know, cool intersections of magic and magic places.
Ruby?
Yeah, who are some of your influences in magic?
Oh, I should have written some of this stuff down. For some reason, there's some part of my brain where I'm terrible with names. Ricky Jay. Ricky Jay, he's a famous magician slash he's in a lot of movies. He wrote a piece called like Ricky Jay and his 52 assistants. Then when I watched it, I was like, oh, that's how magic is supposed to be presented. Jeff McBride, who's that magician that I met out at Burning Man, that I got to be part of a film with him out at Burning Man as well. He's very influential on me. And then Brad Henderson, Austin area mentalist, mind reader. That's who I was up late talking to last night about the virtues of our blend of magic. So yeah, those are three very charismatic, deep thinkers on the art of magic.
I love to hear it. Yeah, kind of growing up, I was what was on like satellite TV, your David Copperfields, your David Blaines. But I was always more like interested in like the puzzles and yeah, that's really cool. What types of magic do you like to currently perform?
Well, I'm trying to push my show to be get into small stages and be able to hit some of the Canadian street performance venues. I went up to the Edmonton Street Performance Festival, and Canadian, since they have like, you know, that connection to French, they love the circus arts, and they had a 10 days of like a performer could come up to a pitch. There'd be 200 people there waiting. They'd perform, cash would just dump out of everywhere, and then they'd leave and the next performer would come up, and I was just like, I've got to get part of this. So I haven't gotten part of that yet, but that's what I've been actively working on, getting media and my act ready for something like that. But also, you know, currently most of my performing is down in Eugene at the Old Nick's Pub. I have a monthly show there, and there's a chance that I'm going to be getting into a theater down there in Eugene somewhat soon. So
best of luck. Kind of moving more on, like to you, what is the relationship between stage magic and the occult?
All right, so I want to hop back just a little bit and talk about some of that, and I'll move right into that. So my own Please particular do. Studies, you know, I'm not just a guy that flicks cards or whatever. Like I said, I moved to Japan. I have a high ranking in Aikido, Judo, Daitoru, all these very Zen and Shinto influenced art forms. I've trained with Taoist monks for a while from Wudang. That was really interesting. And there's just straight folk witchcraft. I was very surprised at what they do. I've been part of the Burning Man community for a long time. So holding, building events, having, you know, it's effectively sacred and profane spaces. Been reading tarot for 23 years. So big study in symbology. Also currently I'm into German ruin studies. So, you know, plunk around with alchemy, theosophy, Jungian archetypes and all that other stuff. So, and then I've been, you know, building dojos and stages for a long time. So I just wanted to have a little bit of a background. So when I start talking a lot about psychology and anthropology stuff, which I've studied, that's kind of my journey through magic is through both this great belief and this great doubt of, So what is my relationship between stage magic and the occult? Well, there's a welcoming of the summer event in Austin, Texas. It's called Eeyore's Birthday, where it's basically everyone piles into the park and drinks beer all day and hippies everywhere with hacky sacks. And it's kind of this welcoming of the summer thing. I was walking around with my friend and we bump into this guy all dressed in black, looking cool. And he had one of those Crowleyite stars, you know, those double V sort of things on there. And we got to talking and I was like, oh yeah, I do magic. And he was looked at me and was, well, I do real magic. Kind of looked down his nose at me. And I was like, Oh, it's on. All right, you do real magic? Do some real magic. Let me see some real magic. Don't, you got nothing? You know, I can have do some with coin. I can do something with this. You don't do anything? All right. Oh, wait. Crowleyite say that magic is being able to change your mind at will. Change your mind. You can't change your mind? Oh, I see your mind change. You went from smug to annoyed. And so that's that's kind of how, anyways, I think I do real magic. And I think a lot of people, we tell ourselves stories and we like to, which is great, because like I said, I'm into myths and everything else, but I think that the magic that I do is the most practical of magics. It connects
well,
me
it's
to people.
glamours and illusion and misdirection and the psychology. There's a lot to doing, quote, magic, stage magic, that I feel being an occultist, especially with the spiritualist background, because the spiritualists are just steeped in this interesting Americana history. Because like Harry Houdini had this love affair with spiritualism, but love-hate affair, right? Because he was also very big on debunking all of the various different fake, I guess, the people that were exploiting other people. Not to say that I don't think that there are, like, I absolutely believe there are spiritualist mediums who have a stronger connection to the other side that exists beyond our earthly carnation. And I think those things don't have to be in conflict with each other. But during this time of, like, you know, materialism science, that was, I think, in some ways even starting to break down because of all the massive amount of death that was happening during the Civil War, which was the impetus for the spiritualist movement, in large part because all the men were dead. So the women were left with their grief and for the first time could start exploring their spirituality in a very powerful, connected way. And hence, you know, the spiritual movement was a space for, you know, women and femme people to have that agency. And so Houdini, I think, believed in it, but then he also always had to be sort of this like avenger of what is real, quote, and what is fake. And I think as a stage magician, you almost play with that liminality in interesting ways that are very occult.
Absolutely. In Zen practice, we have like great faith, great doubt, and great determination is kind of, you know, one of the sayings there. And that great faith and great doubt, I think, is useful for somebody that is interested in this meta concept of what is magic, because humans lie. Humans are frauds everywhere. The spiritualism movement, you know, I'm on a lot of like Taoism boards, and like Chinese magicians are just relentless, putting, you know, tricks out there and trying to build little cults for themselves using it's effectively parlor tricks. And having somebody being able to stand up and go like, hey, I'm all about for performing trips. I'm all tricks. I'm all about trying to create this state of wonder. But when you start controlling other people with this influence, then it crosses this ethical line that, you know.
Yeah. And that also just kind of reminds me of the music world, what you're talking about, and even what you were like bringing up earlier with the like guy who you were able to change his mind from smug to annoyed. That there are, wherever there is a music community, there are gatekeepers that are doing the exact same fucking thing. And frankly, that's kind of been my mission to break that down as much as humanly possible. I just really resonate with that. So I love that.
Yeah, absolutely. And also with the ability to create a space and sort of have this ritual around a and suspending disbelief is, I think, a necessary part for us to cultivate a sense of wonder that is in some ways helping us as humans stay interested and inquisitive about our life and our world. And that's something that magic really cultivates, both in the sense of like the occult, but also in stage magic. And yeah, one of my favorite philosophers, Robert Anton Wilson, likes to say, you know, you have one foot in skepticism and one foot in belief at all times. And the more that you pursue synchronicity, the more just like really wild shit that like occurs in life that then seems to be just more than random coincidences. And I feel like once you start, you know, fucking with the spooky game, it ends up just like making your life a lot more spooky and weird, no matter if it's with stage magic or if it's with the occult, because in some ways it's really kind of the same. It's the same gateway drug.
Yeah, it's very similar. So I have a little paragraph here that I'd like to read to you. That's the beginning of my show, right? Or a lot of times it says, "The ancient art of magic seeks to do what no other art can do. Other arts will thrill you, move you, perhaps show you something beautiful, but magic is unique because it directly confronts you with the impossible. It is a dance whose goal is to bring you to a state of wonder. It is the art of astonishment. For a magician, this is our most precious gift, awe and astonishment. In a whimsical way, a magician is a preacher of possibility and impossibility and a purveyor of fine wonders. I invite you today to invite you and help making magic happen. I'm not here to trick you. I'm not here to fool you or challenge your intellect. I merely want to show you something beautiful. Magic is not a puzzle to be solved. It is a dance of perception to be savored.
I love that. Yeah, that is really gives an intention to magic that I appreciate, you know, because I mean, I have to say, I'm kind of a mean critic to my husband when he does his little magic tricks for me. But also, I want him to get better. Like, if he fucks it up, I'm going to tell him, I'm like, you've just fucked that up. Like, get better at that before you show me again. So I kind of have...
It's a very, very difficult art form because, like I said, we are trying to accomplish the impossible. So, yeah, there are a lot of ways to mess it up.
Right. And, you know, it's good to have somebody if you want to do magic as a performance, that it be something that you get good at performing. But also, you know, my other experience with some of these magicians like Chris Angel. And God, he was so fucking obnoxious with his magic. And it kind of annoyed, I think, a lot of people more than I think it impressed them. I don't know. That's my hot take on Chris Angel.
I was sitting at a table next to Chris Angel last summer. And overall, you know, I don't know him, more power to him, whatever. I'm glad I wish him all the success. But overall, the presence was kind of annoying. So
yeah.
Chris just Angel, like, and the magic of capitalism.
Yeah. Yes. But it just seems like, I don't know, he has a very egocentric aspect to it. And you make it almost like the intention of, like, let's collaborate on making this a wondrous experience. Kind of like the way I approach running Dungeons and Dragons. I'm always like, this is a collaborative activity that we all are participating in. I'm just the game engine here to bend the rules to my particular will, but at the same time, I'm going to do it in a way that facilitates the story for my players. And Ruby's actually a player in two of my games. Yes. I'm another player with you in one game, though. We play a lot of D&D online. It's kind of like our little family bonding time at this point, because my brother's our DM.
It's magic because I think all of human existence, but it's storytelling, and now you're getting into a very direct collaborative storytelling environment. So I think the process is fascinating. And another magician that I was talking to has been running a D&D game for 20 years now, and we were having this exact conversation.
You know, I absolutely love the similarities in the objectives in what you're talking about magic does and how it aligns with what I believe music and music performance does. They go together just so well, just in the sense that ultimately all you're trying to do is tell a good story, like decorate time as well as a magician decorates space
and time. That's right. So actually, I guess I this week I meditated deeply on what are the goals of magic, and big word magic, I don't care if you put K's at the end of it or whatever, but it's what are the goals. And in stage magic, we always say that the ultimate goal is transformation of yourself and transformation of your audience, which, I mean, that's probably lifted right from alchemy, or alchemy stole it from us. I was also thinking about, what are the goals? Knowledge. I think most magical occult practices are in the search of some sort of knowledge. You have your book of knowledge or your group of knowledge, but you're trying to get to some sort of secret or gnosis, where it's a knowledge given by the divine, or a Satori enlightenment sort of experience, you know, coming from the Eastern. So we have knowledge is one thing that we're searching for in stage magic, or just in magic. I'm not even going to differentiate it. Power. And I think that occultists are, a lot of them are searching through, you know, a fantasy of gaining some sort of power, whether it's healing or harming or fortune telling or something. So we have knowledge and power are two goals of magic. I thought of this as connection. I think connection is a huge goal of joining any, you know, secret society or anything else. You're connecting to a lineage, you're connecting to other people, but also, you know, depending on what flavor of magic you're doing, you have invocations. Are you trying to connect with spirits or genies or fairies or whatever else? So, and finally, you know, I think that the final goal is transformation or some sort of altered state, I suppose, of, you know, something has changed, that satori or enlightenment, or you're living in accordance with the Tao, or, you know, shooting lightning everywhere or whatever. So anyway, so that's what I came up with. I don't know if you guys agree. So there were search of knowledge, power, connection, and transformation. This is magic.
And I'm kind of thinking a little bit about how in particle physics, we have demonstrated that the moment you are there to observe any matter, a particle of matter, it changes. And they know that by the difference from readings from when there is a human observation being made on the stuff of the universe. And somebody at Mystic South this past year had stood up at our panel and asked why we don't talk about particle physics more in on the Science Witch podcast. And that's in large part because I'm not a particle physicist. I could not begin to even approach the kind of math that is required for that sort of scientific expertise. I could fuck with chemistry because that's a lot more of, you know,
give me 3 weeks, I'll brush up.
But yeah, I mean, exactly. I want to be able to have a really informed and, you know, interesting conversation about how the fact that literally our human consciousness changes the matter that makes up the universe when we are directly observing it. And I think that is a really like powerful idea for the ability of us as those who are occultists who want to wield these different powers of the universe to shape and be able to manifest our will, that, you know, this sort of idea of playing with like, as I will it, so mote it be, no matter what it is, stage magic or magic with a K, that it makes it all the more powerful. Yeah, it's like, yeah, and synergistic. But I wanted to ask you this question. And what are the ethical implications of using occult imagery and symbolism in your stage show? And do you think that, you know, let's hear your thoughts on that topic.
Well, and of course, my central thesis is that magicians are a lineage of this esoteric or occult hidden knowledge sort of lineages. So everything that an occultist used, you may have stolen it from us in the first place. So, but I was talking about it with a buddy last night about like kind of the waves of magic imagery throughout the centuries. And of course, you know, the first magic book that was ever written was, I think, in 1568 by Sir Reginald Scott, called the Discovery of Witchcraft, 1584. And it was intended as an expose on witchcraft, but it goes through what all the magical entertainers at the time were using about how they could cut the heads off chickens, or, you know, how these guillotines work and all the other and whatnot. And so already, I mean, I'm under the belief that a lot of these witchcrafty powers that people have always had are already developed by magicians. Like a lot of these ideas of like the warrior priests, like the Kung Fu Shaolin guys that have all these powers. Well, there's magicians that hang out everywhere around those temples and are performing magic tricks, but in the guise of a martial arts master. And so we've always woven these things in with our performance, and we follow at the times the ethical considerations. I don't know. Well, I think that it's made something like a card trick more into a story. And actually, I have, like, in the 1970s, I guess in England, it was card tricks were very pub sort of tricks, and, you know, birthday party sorts of stuff, where there was always this campy cheesiness to it. But there arose in opposition to this idea, this is a giant book I'm holding up called The Complete Invocation, where British magicians started doing called storytelling magic, and they were doing storytelling magic, wrapping it in like, let's see if I can find good pictures in here with like tarot and occult imagery and Cthulhu stuff and I can't twist the pictures around. Anyways, it's a brilliant book, and it's all weaving occult messages into popular effects. I even have, let's see, somewhere, oh, where'd I put it? Oh, here we go. The Book of Thoth. This is all how to do magic with tarot cards, you know, weaving stories and spells and bringing the lore of, you know, occult knowledge into a performance piece. As far as ethics go, I don't know. I think people are always going to cross the line and mess up. And well, because people are selfish a lot of times. And some of the ethics that I've seen crossed over. I'll talk about one instance. Last summer, I was performing at an event and I was doing metal bending. Metal bending is an illusion. It was made by Uri Geller and a guy named Bannon back in the 60s. And now it's gotten so ingrained into our society that we believe that this psychic entertainment is a real thing that people can do. I'm personally doubtful of that. I've pursued it for a long time. I'll be the first to figure it out if I can, but it is an illusion. I was performing and a local lady, beautiful young lady, alchemist up in Portland saw me doing it. And her eyes just suddenly was just like, I finally found my teacher. You are going to teach me this thing and I will, you know, and I was just like, the line from Ghostbusters ran through my head where I was just like, if somebody asks you if you're a god, you say yes. But alas, me being an ethical sort of person, I was like, I'll teach it to you. But I just want you to know, first of all, that this is an illusion, you know, and you just saw a dream from, you know, like I the hope that she had for magic in the world was suddenly drained. But the only reason that I pulled that is because I don't want to be a cult leader, you know, that, you know, I am here to entertain. I'm here to make your world pretty bright and to have a good time. But I'm not here to be your
not the guru, the guru this time around.
But there has been a lot of interesting combinations of like, you know, using illusions and crossing that line, like Robert Anton Wilson, and of course in his book Sex, Drugs, and the Occult, he talks about Hassani Sabah and the assassins, and about how that he would basically, you know, he had a headless illusion where he could, you know, claim that he executed one of his soldiers and then show his head screaming, and that, you know, oh, I'm locked in hell for I crossed the master Hassani Sabah, you know, and then he was using illusions in order to cast this really powerful, like he is a god sort of thing. Also, there's in the very, very famous history in magical history lore is Robert Houdin, who is really, when we think about the modern magician, he is the one that totally rebuilt things with the suits and the top hats. But he was actually asked by Louis Napoleon to go to French Algeria and perform because there were some African magicians, I believe, at the time that were leading a tribe out there with their talk about magic and faux magical abilities. But when Robert Houdin got there, he famously has this heavy light box where he could challenge anybody to pick up a box and nobody can, but he could pick it up. And then he did a bullet catch, caught a bullet, signed bullet in his teeth. And that was enough to actually, you know, make the tribes follow him. And then, you know, basically doing the mission for France and pacified things through magic. Is it ethical? I don't know. Probably not. But
that's fascinating. So I have to admit, I ran this through Bard, the Google AI, to kind of generate some questions, and then I kind of like reworded some of them, but I thought this was an interesting idea. And when you brought up the what you have like is the sort of pillars of your intention about magic, power was one of them. And as magicians and people in the occult, there's mutualistic ways to wield power, and then there's destructive ways to wield power. And I think maybe that was something that was sort of being sensed in the AI's strange and almost at this point unknowable way of collating information to create whatever these questions are. So, but yeah, that's really interesting that you had mentioned something about like cult leaders and just like having the access to this hidden knowledge, which in some ways magicians just continue to have, because you need to have like occult knowledge in order to do these very elaborate illusions, and you don't want to share it too widely because then, you know, the illusion would be dispelled. But yeah, and then, you know, there could be like cults of personality. So I don't know, that was just an interesting thing that I wanted to throw at you. But yeah, there's like the history of stage magic, I think, is one of the most really interesting looks at the occult. I read a book about, oh goodness, I'll have to look it up and put it in the show notes because the author's name is not coming to me, but it's all about the occult developed in the United States. And they had an entire chapter, which is where I got a lot of my information about Houdini and his connection to spiritualism, because I think that's really fascinating, like American history that a lot of times you don't hear about until you start listening to podcasts, right? Because it's not taught in school. But, you know, just this almost tortured back and forth between belief and disbelief of wanting to know that there's something more like paranormal in the world, but also knowing enough about how to create these illusions that you're the one that has to debunk all the people who are using this power unethically.
So it's like James Randi, you know, of course, was, you know, famous magician that, you know, turned debunker in his later years. But yeah, that's part of our power. I mean, we build illusions, we dispel them. So
yeah.
But I found for you, I thought you might find this interesting as a cultist, because I think that really, as you know, we have these secret bodies of information that we're searching for, right? But I think there is this fantasy that we do have as magicians, all of us as magicians, that we're trying to, that maybe there's some power that we develop. And this is a list of 20 magic powers that almost all fall into the idea. And I was reading them, and I was like, yeah, I think that people that are trying to be Harry Potter or searching for some occult power, they all fall into this particular list. So if you're interested.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Of course, productions, being able to make something appearing out of nothing. And of course, is it Sai Baba, an Indian mystic or whatever, does that all the time, producing coins, and everyone is, oh, holy coins from the heavens, you know. Of course, vanishing. Transposition, being able to change locations, you know, transformation, being able to change from one thing into another. Of course, probably the root of all magic and, you know, alchemy. Things being able to go through one another, penetrations are called. Restoration, being able to making something that's destroyed whole. I guess even resurrection would fall under that. I mean, I believe Jesus was part of that
necromancy.
Yeah. Animation, being able to make something that is not supposed to have personalities move around, such as wands or canes or silks or balls floating through the air, such as David Bowie. Let's see. So anti-gravity, of course. I mean, there's been saints that have done, you know, being able to levitate and float. Attraction, mysterious connections, being able to lock something on and not have it move or on you. Sympathetic reactions, of course, that's a whole genre of magic. Sympathetic magic, taking the voodoo doll and being able to influence something else. Invulnerability, that's a huge thing in magic, being able to take spears or swords right through the body or blades. Of course, a lot of escape acts are, I guess, kind of like that. Let's see, physical anomalies, of course, that's you know, freaks, or you know, a lot of magicians actually do learn to put needles through their bodies and stuff. We have control.
Oh, yeah. My husband and one of our really longtime friends have a fascination for freak shows. And so he actually was studying to do blockhead stuff. And I put the kibosh on that. I was like,
funny. And my wife did the same thing. She walked in and I had a nail sticking out of my head. And she was like, nope.
Nope. That one's not. That one's getting vetoed.
Yeah. It's interesting, but yeah, a buddy of mine I perform with a lot, Dan Block down in Austin, that's his whole shtick. You know, he put everything up his nose, and you know, he can put a balloon up his nose and it comes out of his mouth, and then he ties it into it, he inflates it and ties it into a dog, and then, you know, he sticks the nail in his nose and hits it with a taser and all kinds of stuff. And I was like, all right, well, maybe I didn't miss a whole lot by not pursuing that. There are other artists that can do that, but anyway, a few more powers: mind reading, thought reading, of course, and prediction of the future and extrasensory perception. And interestingly, Fitzky also says that superhuman skill is also a form of magic, which I do agree with. But anyways, those are all of the main performance powers. But when I was looking at it, trying to relate it to the occult, I think that every power that people think they can generate through the practice of magic kind of falls under one of those categories, except for that connection, or I think divine knowledge comes into that extrasensory perception. So anyways.
Yeah, well, the last one about, like, that's sort of the approach of the psychic, which does, not for stage magic, but for like psychic development. Matt Aron is the writer, and I like it because it's a very like structured witchcraft book that gives you all these like meditation tools, as well as like ways to psychically, in some ways, construct your various witchcraft exercises, like making wards and stuff like that. And it's been one of my favorite witchcraft books to come out recently. But yeah, I mean, and then one of the sort of hypotheses of this that I've developed is like, all humans have these, what we would see as like extrasensory or psychic abilities. It's just, you know, capitalism and the churn of modernity deadens it, right? And so this is one of those ways that the lineage of this occult wisdom, that this magic was able to be transmitted. And now, like, we're seeing this a moment where it's a lot more accessible to a lot more people through the incredible medium of podcasting, where we are literally the voices inside someone's head right now, listening to us. Hi, out there. And yeah, I mean, I think that's one of the things about this sort of liminal place, that stage magic is basically the most closely associated inheritor of that occult wisdom, that in some ways we get to really have this incredible revival and be at that alive at that time. And that's, yeah.
So one of the things that I did want to share, that like a shout out to my magic teacher, who actually has events that are like occult study, or, you know, symbology study events called like Phoenix Rising. Jeff McBride runs something with his group, is called the Mystery School, which is, of course, a direct nod to the, you know, the Grecian mystery schools of magic, and where magicians get together and, you know, learn drumming and learn, you know, talk about some of these, you know, Kundalini rising / Kabbalah sorts of concepts together. So anyways, magicians are also having formal training in that too. So it's we're using the guise of the, oh, it's, we're just stage magicians to, you know, actually get together and pursue these concepts deeper. And because I think we're all drunk on whatever this concept of magic is, you know. It's and I honestly, I've spent all week trying to think about defining the occult, and I'm not really sure. I mean, it's another nonsense word, like magic, like means secret, hidden, like arcana or rune, you know. All right, well, what is it? Tell me more. As a anthropology study student, I was just like, all right, well, it's a collection of symbols. It's a culture in of itself. It's like it's the books and lore and societies and myths and costume and history of a particular field of knowledge. It's the story that we tell ourselves, and life is story, and it's another little theater of the mind. At least that's my conclusion after a week of intensive thoughts on it.
Makes sense.
Yeah. Do you have do you want to have any other questions, Ruby?
I had them written down somewhere, but I lost.
No, it's okay. I have a thought, and this has been one we've kind of closed a lot of our interviews lately. And I think it's just because it's such a inflection point we're at as a society, as Pluto is moving into Aquarius out of Capricorn. And AI is just so scarily here. I think in some ways, humanity is not quite ready or awakened or aware of how much AI is able to now create these illusions that are completely fabricated, you know, in ways that stage magicians try to aspire to. And so, yeah, like, what are your thoughts and reflections on this point we're at in our development as humans?
Well, I don't... We're doomed. There we go.
We're doomed.
No, I do think it's interesting, especially the misdirection and the shaping of realities that's going on in like the political realm, that an objective event can happen. And just seeing the mental gymnastics and spin that a media organization can misdirect everyone. And over the course of several months, looking back, and a particular political event can go through six different generations of the stories that are told about it. And the conclusions are at the end from this particular misdirection are completely different than what happened. And so this reality rewriting, and I think it's absolutely horrific. And it's really weird to see the mental gymnastics that that my fellow human beings can do to justify their thoughts or their behaviors, you know, arguing with me that this ball is not white when indeed it is. But, you know, is there an objective reality? I'm not sure about that. But the subjective realities are kind of runaway. And getting into the concept of illusions and trying to misdirect people or trying to implant their perceptions, that I think that the deepfake videos and this particular election cycle are going to be very, very challenging. I already saw that any evidence coming forth with Roger Stone, he was already saying, oh, it's all AI, it's all fake, it's all fake, it's all AI. And so even being able to protect your own bad behaviors with saying that everything is deep faked is, yeah, there's going to be lots of problems with illusions coming up, I think.
Mm-hmm. Do you think there's anything? Like with... Oh, yeah, go ahead, Ruby.
This is something I've been having a lot of conversations with one of my college best friends for, is whether what is propaganda? Like, at its heart, all it is writing that is meant to convince another person of an argument. And absolutely, AI factoring into that absolutely plays into what you just said.
Mm. Do you think of any more optimistic potential for it?
Well, for AI or for just our humans going forward?
I don't know, both, either, I guess.
I think that as one element is summoned, you have a yin and yang, of course. Yeah. So for every tool, for every swing of the pendulum of politics or ethics or society, that you'll get a counter swing. And you just have to, you know, find the areas, find the tribe, move towards the sacred and away from the profane and your own world as much as possible, and learn to in martial arts we have a concept called mai, the distance that you need to keep from something that is a bad energy, right? And so try to keep make your own territory and surround yourself with the people that will enrich you and not pull you down.
Absolutely.
And I think that, I'm definitely seeing that in society, like coming from, I helped establish the regional burn network, whereas people are just like, oh, we went out to Burning Man and had a great time. We should share this culture of people getting together. And, you know, it's, you know, tailgating, it's fun, it's building art, it's trying to amaze each other, it's generosity, it's a potlatch of sorts of giving away your resources for a celebration. And then I've seen, went from the very first burn party where it was, you know, 30 people out in Texas somewhere to now it's an international sort of phenomenon where Texas has 5 of these events, and you know, there's probably about 50 of them in the United States. And so yeah, I mean, humans are challenging, they're also capable of beautiful things, and that's always going to be what our walk through life is. We will use illusions and misdirections and for both good and evil, and it's just the nature of humans.
Nice. So like, this is kind of what you're saying is like, at its heart, it's a tool that can be, yeah, it's a tool in the same way that a hammer and gun are a tool.
Yeah, well, I think magic is absolutely that. And that metaphor is played over and over and over again in literature, where you have, you know, you have the Gandalf and you have the Saruman, you have this and that, and magic is symbols but it will be used for greatness, and it will be used for selfishness, and throughout all times, because that's just what people do. People be people. And
I was gonna ask if your thoughts were that AI could be used in stage magic in some innovative way.
The one thing that I thought was very interesting on one of a magician site, somebody put up a talk to Harry Houdini sort of chat bot. And I haven't done any chatbot things before or since, but I spent probably about an hour and 20 minutes to talking with Harry Houdini, and it was really good. Of course, I had this vast knowledge of, you know, Houdini's life and whatever else, but had a really it was really, really great, and I was thoroughly entertained by this. So it was kind of being finally the every year there's the Houdini seance at the Magic Castle where they try to summon the spirit of Houdini, and for the first time I was like, oh, this is it, found it, you know. Houdini is alive again
via been conjured from beyond in ways that I think he would appreciate that the way it goes. Well, thank you so much, Eric Sensei Strange, for coming on our show. It was really lovely to speak with you, and I absolutely would like to continue having you back at some point. We'll circle back, and eventually I would like to go to Burning Man, though I'm very happy I didn't go this past year, because that was dramatic.
It was great. It was fine. But I think, you know, future episodes too, like, I'm heavy in the martial arts world, and the occult knowledge in the martial arts is an infinite magic topic in itself.
You couldn't even begin to do that one justice. So, but yes, thank you so much.
And thank you guys.
Yeah, we will go ahead and sign off. Thank you so much to Sensei Strange for coming on the show. We hope to follow up with some other topics we discussed, including martial arts and Japan, since, James, you have that connection, and in a later episode. But for now, let's talk about how you can help support the podcast and ensure that we have the resources to keep the lights on.
Yeah, so first off, we do have a Patreon. We have several different levels that gives you different benefits depending on how you're willing to support us. At our entry $1 level, you'll gain access to our extra bonus content as well as our early release episodes one day before they're put out on the main RSS feed. Lately, I've been experimenting from an old sampling keyboard from the early mid-90s, and if I actually make a sound that I like, I'll put it there. You'll be able to hear it there. Angel also posts footage from their yoga classes, and once we start featuring ads on the Science Witch podcast, this will be the way you will be able to access our content ad-free. So if you don't like hearing those gimme-money ads, please consider supporting us on Patreon.
Yeah, and then, yes, and at the $5 a month level, you will receive roughly one sticker a month from our sticker exchange, where we invite artists in our Science Witch Art Coven to contribute art of either deity or a spiritual concept. I just got done sending out the stickers for the last couple of months, including the Nyx sticker, and I'm about to start working on the next sticker, which I think is going to be Baphomet, because I've just been really loving me some Baphomet lately. And I have some art that I did a couple years ago that has just been waiting to get digitalized. Also, if you don't want to have a monthly subscription, but you still really like our stickers and other merch, check us out on Etsy, because I just put the Nyx stickers up on Etsy where you can buy them a la carte.
And at our $10 level, you'll gain access to our Science Witch Coven, where Angel offers a tarot reading service over Zoom, as well as our Patreon-exclusive Discord channels. Speaking of Discord, if you're unable to financially contribute, we'd love to hear what you have to say on all of our other Discord servers that are free and open to the public. We've been getting a lot more traffic there lately, so join on the conversation.
And you can find us on the social medias. We're on Threads, Instagram, and Facebook as the Science Witch Podcast. And you can still find us on Twitter as @ScienceWitchPod. Don't forget, we have a YouTube channel, and we're hoping to increase the quality content on there if you're on YouTube. If you want to check out the show notes and transcripts from this episode, see our website at sciencewitchpodcast.com. Finally, if you hate social media, fair, and you still want to reach out, you can email us at questions@sciencewitchpodcast.com.
As of right now, we have about 690 Spotify monthly listeners or subscribers. We're really hoping to hit 1,000 so that we can start receiving ad revenue. So not only are you listening, but hopefully you're telling all your friends to join us on Spotify and add to that monthly listener count.
So until next time,
live long
and prosper
and blessed be.